on. I'm thinking there must be something in the water at the Reed household, because we had some strange dreams last night, which I won't tell you about Lisa's, although I will say it involves a chicken coop, a corn crib, and a whole bunch of cats. I'm going to leave it at that. You can ask her about it later. But I will tell you about mine. And Margaret, I meant to tell you this ahead of time so as not to surprise you, but surprise. I had a dream last night that that I had to finish my sermon, right? So that's sort of a normal thing to dream on a Saturday night. But I also had a dream I had to finish my sermon and rent an apartment for Margaret. And I wasn't sure about why. I just knew it had to be kept a secret. And I stressed in my dream all night long, will I have time to finish my sermon and rent an apartment for Margaret? And so I woke up in the morning, and it was like, 5 a.m. And I was so relieved, and my first thought was, yes, I have more time to rent an apartment for Margaret still. And I got out of bed. And I got out of bed and thought, I'm not sure that's real. I don't think I'm so... And I couldn't remember. And it took me halfway through my shower before I thought, no, I don't think I have to rent an apartment for Margaret. Yeah. And why it had to be secret, I don't know. I'm not sure what all that is about. But maybe there's some meanings there. And in fact, maybe one story can have more meaning. And maybe that, in fact, will help us today as we read the story we received from our gospel. Our scripture readings today are fantastic. I don't know if you experienced that same thing, but I felt it as we read the psalm, and it said, righteousness and peace will kiss each other. What beautiful imagery. And then in 1 Kings, God was not in the wind. God was not in the earthquake. God was not in the fire, but in the sound of sheer silence. Again, what beautiful language. And from Romans that Amelia read, the word is near you. It's on your lips. It's in your heart. It's beautiful, poetic language. And then there's this. Jesus said to him, you of little faith, why did you doubt? And I wonder, am I the only one here today bothered by Jesus' words to Peter at the close of this passage? After all those beautiful scriptures, am I the only one here troubled that that is what Jesus said to him? You of little faith, why did you doubt? And let me be clear, I don't mean to say that I'm bothered by Jesus pointing out the reality of little faith or even chronic doubt. Those are merely facts of life, and I have no problem with Jesus commenting on them. But what I do mean to say is, I'm troubled at just when Jesus says those words today. And I'm finding them difficult to understand in their gospel context. So consider with me, if you will, our scene once again. Here's how it goes. Jesus has just sent his disciples out on a small boat into the center of the sea. A sea, by the way, due to its low-lying position in a valley and the fact that it's surrounded by hills, is notorious for rather sudden and violent storms. And sure enough, as the sun sets that day, a squall rises, and the disciples find themselves battered and bullied by the wind and the waves. In the Greek, the word is actually tortured. The disciples found themselves tortured by winds and waves in the sea. And just then, after struggling all night in their 16-foot sloop, a shadowy figure suddenly appears on the sea, walking towards them, walking atop the waters. It is a sight so frightening, they believe they are seeing a ghost. I loved how you read that, Wendy. They believe they are seeing a ghost. The winds and waves are one thing, but a ghastly, ghostly figure walking to you across the sea is quite another. And so, for the first time that night in the midst of the storm, those grown men cry out in fear, Matthew tells us. To which Jesus responds, "Take heart, it is I." Or more literally, "Take heart, I am. Do not be afraid." Which, to be honest, is almost comical to think about, given how absolutely outrageous this whole scene already is. I'm not sure the knowledge that it's Jesus out there standing on the water is any more comforting to them than the thought that it may have been a ghost. Not to mention, who can really say if this is Jesus out there or not? I mean, how do we know it's not Davy Jones and his crew trying to lure us in? And so, we come to Peter. Peter, the unsolicited spokesperson for his peers in every situation, Peter immediately, and rather prudently in my mind, calls out for a bit of proof. Only because it's Peter, and Peter can be a bit daft at times, he doesn't ask something sensible like everyone in this room would have asked. Something like, "If it's really you, Lord, tell me what we had for breakfast this morning." Or, "If it's really you, Jesus, tell me what Philip's middle name is." But rather, the brash, impetuous, speak first, think later, Peter shouts out across the sea, "Lord, if it's you, bid me to come in." Into the storm, into the waves, into the wind, into the sea. "Bid me, Lord, to come." And I gotta say, Peter may be a bit daft at times, but that guy has got guts. And so, hearing Peter's request, Jesus says, "Come." And that crazy fisherman, for reasons I cannot entirely comprehend, swings his legs over the side of that boat and hops in the middle of a squall, on the Sea of Galilee, when the dawn has not yet fully dispersed the darkness of night, Peter jumps in. And for me, for one shining, glorious moment, this is the greatest thing that's ever occurred. For one shining moment, he actually stands atop that sea. One step, two steps, closer and closer to Jesus. Until, of course, until those Galilean winds and waves capture his attention and imagination once more. And he suddenly sinks like the rock he is. A beautiful line I once read somewhere, but I can't remember where. But it's beautiful nonetheless. Peter sinks so fast that he only has time for three words. "Lord, save me." And of course, Jesus does, pulling Peter to the boat so his buddies can haul him up by the armpits on over the edge and onto the surface of that small ship. At which point, Jesus says, "You, of little faith, why did you doubt?" And again, given the context of what we've just read, I have to ask, am I the only one bothered by this? Let me put it this way. Do you have old videos of your children and grandchildren, maybe nieces or nephews, saying their first words or taking their first steps? Do you have these old videos? Ours are so old, they're actually on tapes. We have them on tapes from way back when. What do you do with tapes nowadays? Anyway, the point being, we've got tons of them. First moments in our children's lives that we were so excited to witness, we felt compelled to put them on film. But what stands out to us when we all sit around and go back and watch these tapes is not merely the amazing moments, but the over-the-top, overdone, outlandish reactions Lisa and I offer to every one of these moments. It's comical listening to us first-time parents. Parker says something like, "Baga," and we go nuts, certain that he's quoting Shakespeare. I think he said, "to be." I think he's quoting Hamlet. He takes his first step. We're on the phone to the Guinness Book of World Records wondering if there's ever been a kid quite like this. We are overdone. And before you laugh too hard at us, remember this. I've seen a few of your tapes as well, and you do the exact same thing. Our loved ones achieve some small feat. They say two syllables together that sound like a word. They take their first step, and we start gushing, right? We're like a fire hose drenching our children in oohs and ahs, and let's enroll them in Harvard right now, Lisa. We can't help ourselves, which is exactly why Jesus' words are so startling, because Jesus does none of that. In fact, just the opposite. Despite the fact that Peter has just walked on water, Jesus turns to him in the boat and says, "You, of little faith, why did you doubt?" Whereas I expect him to say, "That was awesome. What a start. Let's see if we can get 10 steps next time." What we get instead is, "That's all you got?" And I, for one, find those words bewildering. Not merely astonishing or surprising, but actually flabbergasting, I think about captures it. Why did you doubt? Are you kidding me? Peter just stepped out on the sea in the midst of a storm in the only dry clothes he had with him. And not only did he not immediately sink, he actually took a few steps. You call that doubt? I'm not sure anyone has ever demonstrated such faith. To this day, apart from God incarnate, Peter still holds the undisputed world record for the most steps walked on water without sinking, because no one else has ever made it past zero before. And yet, Jesus says, "You of little faith, why did you doubt?" Which feels like saying to 8-month-old Parker, "What? No cartwheels? Come on, kid." Jesus' response to Peter is so perplexing, half of me wonders if Matthew simply misrecorded it. Because in what world is any amount of walking on water a sign of little faith and doubt? So, what in the world are we to make of all of this? How are we to account for Jesus' rather stupefying statement? Well, as one biblical scholar puts it, what if there is more to this story than simply walking on water? That is, without denying the literal details of the event themselves, what if Matthew's purpose in telling this story is actually to share with us a parable? And if so, what might Matthew be trying to say? For what if Jesus' question to Peter is not about walking on water at all, but rather walking on faith? But what might that even mean? Let me ask you this. What's your comfort level with large bodies of deep water? Just you personally, what's your comfort level with that? Having grown up a stone's throw from the Puget Sound, I can think of nothing more enjoyable than a long cruise through the ocean or sea, perhaps the Mediterranean or the Caribbean. Lisa, on the other hand, having grown up in landlocked Iowa, where the largest body of water is the Wapsipinicon River, which at spaces is about 6 feet wide and 6 feet deep, can think of no vacation she'd rather avoid than a cruise in the Caribbean or anywhere else for that matter. And I wonder, how about you? What is your comfort with large bodies of deep water? Because if you are at all like Lisa, today's story is in fact made for you. You see, for the first century Jews, a sea is not merely a sea. It's not a place where one goes to vacation or party. Rather, The sea is an ancient symbol of the primordial abyss, the void, the darkness, the Tahom, to use the Hebrew word from Genesis 1. It is an ancient symbol that stands in opposition to the harmony of the universe. Whatever is opposite to the very harmony of the universe, that is what the sea stands for. The sea, in other words, is a symbol of chaos, the metaphorical abode of all the demonic forces of this world, however you think of them. All the violence, the injustice, the oppression, the terror that mars God's good creation, each of these is symbolized in the first century culture by the sea. To speak of the sea is to speak about the dark abyss of evil that we encounter in this world, which is why Psalms like 65:7 promise God will still the roaring of the seas. It's not just about water. It's about the evil that dwells in this world. God will still the roaring of the waves and the turmoil of the nations. And Isaiah 43:16 proclaims, it is God who will make a way in the sea, the chaos, the abyss, a path in the mighty waters. So that when Matthew describes Jesus walking across the sea today, atop those waves, Matthew is not simply making a statement about gravity here. He's trying to make a statement about cosmic realities, about ways of being in this world. What Matthew seems to be proclaiming in this parable is this. This man, this human being who walks across the waters, this kingdom he's come to preach is the antidote to the chaos that threatens to drown us all. Which means, when Peter steps out of that boat, which, by the way, boats were a symbol in the first century for the church, which is to say, when Peter steps out of the safe confines of his community and enters a tumultuous world, the sea, the question is not, as I originally thought, can he walk on water? The question, rather, is this. Will he trust that walking in the way of Christ can make a difference at all in our chaotic world? Or will he be drowned by the chaos around him? You see, Peter's biggest challenge, and you remember him in Matthew's gospel, Peter's biggest challenge throughout the entire gospel is not believing Jesus is Messiah. He's got that down. His biggest challenge is believing that the Messiah can defeat evil with a cross. That is, Peter's biggest challenge is not belief. His biggest challenge is trust in the way of Christ. Two chapters from now, in chapter 16 of Matthew's gospel, Peter will be the first to proclaim that Jesus is Lord. You are the Messiah, the Son of God, to which Jesus will say, on this rock I will build my church. Only to say a few verses later in verse 23 of chapter 16, get behind me, Satan, which he says to Peter when Peter tells Jesus that the cross is incompatible with being a king. And I'd like to suggest that is precisely what this story is about as well. When Jesus asks Peter why he doubts, he doesn't mean, why can't you walk on water any better, Peter? For the fact is, and thank God, walking on water has never been a test of discipleship for any of us, not in any literal sense. When Paul is shipwrecked, no one presumes they could have simply walked on water to the shore. The story would have had no punch if that was the case. Walking on water has never been a test of discipleship. That is not the point here. Rather, what we receive today is a parable about Peter's and our own commitment and trust to the way of Christ. When the chaos rages, what will we do? You see, Jesus walks through the sea of life by refusing the very ways of the sea. Where it rages with violence, he practices peace. Where it harms, Jesus steps in and tries to heal. Where it devours, Jesus helps restore. Where it kills, Jesus says, "My purpose is to bring life." And only thus does he overcome the sea, triumphantly walking atop the chaos. Which means this rich story is meant as a question, not simply to Peter, but to all of us. Will we trust that peaceableness, remember righteousness and peace will kiss one another? Peaceableness is what you and I are made for. Will we practice it when all around us is chaos and violence and something else? Will we vote for it when everyone else votes for power and wealth and noise and arrogance? Will we proclaim it even when the winds and waves of the critics say to us, it's just not possible to live like Jesus did? Will we trust that this, the way of Christ, is the way God has chosen to overcome the storms? As G.K. Chesterton once famously quipped, and I love this line, the Christian ideal has not been tried and found wanting. Rather, it's been found difficult and left untried. So that over and over and over again, we enter those waters and sink right back down into the sea, becoming just like it. Today, with Jesus' rather bothersome question, we actually receive a challenge. Will we trust? And yet, we'd be remiss not to mention there's a promise here as well. A promise that when we do, in fact, sink, just like Peter the rock who sank so many times, when we doubt Jesus' way in this chaotic world, he is nonetheless still there to reach out a hand and save us anyway, so that we might try yet again to walk on water. Someday we pray, the storms of this life will in fact end. Peace will reign. But until then, our question this morning is simple. Are we willing to walk through this chaotic sea of life like Jesus did, carrying a cross so that the sword can no longer sink us? May God grant us such faith. Amen.